Hey, everybody, I'm Andy Weinberg, and welcome to episode 72 of the David Ossikkonen in the Pocket podcast. Coming to you live on PhillyRockRadio.com. And, of course, we're here in the studios at Wildfire Radio in Woodbury, New Jersey, where you can find us on anywhere where you get your podcast. Hey, Dave, you know what Sunday is?
Let me think. Not offhand.
Sunday will be our 2-year anniversary. Will mark 2 years since we started this thing, and it's still going great.
What are we going to do to celebrate? Today it's kind of cool.
We could celebrate today because we have a guest with us today who, if you've listened to, I don't know, any record in the last 40 years, there's a good chance that this guy worked on it because he's worked on, I don't know, according to allmusic.com, he has 575 credits.
Wow.
So, and that's just in the last 2 weeks.
Right. It's wonderful.
His name is John Aniello. He is a producer, engineer, mixer, arranger, pretty much anybody in the rock or alternative world of the last 40 years, there's a good chance he's been involved in their projects. So very excited. And including many of the projects that you've worked on, Dave.
Years ago, you started
with the Hooters and some other stuff that you've been involved in, which we'll get to. So we're very excited to celebrate our 2 years with a great guest.
Happy birthday, Andy.
Happy birthday, Dave.
Happy anniversary.
Whatever it is, 2 years. Thanks to the people at Wildfire Radio who got us going, Marcus Darpino and our producer now, Taylor, whose last name I never even try to pronounce. As you know,
You can take a try at it.
Curtatus.
Yeah. Well, Dave, as you know, I'm horrible with last name pronunciation.
Listen, man, I've heard a lot worse, man.
But I got our guest pronunciation right this week, John Aniello. Yeah. It's not spelled anything like that. But anyway, before we get to John, I do want to mention that we are once again brought to you this week by GotPeace.com. Trudy Handelman, we can't thank you enough for your support of the show. GotPeace.com, they produce all kinds of really cool items that just promote messages of peace. They got T-shirts, they got caps, they've got little stuffed cows, dog tag necklaces. Check it out. Spread the messages of peace because, as always, we can use more of that in the world.
I spoke to her last night, and she's doing amazing things. She's up in the Pacific Northwest area, and she's got other things happening. She's one of these extreme entrepreneurs that's got herself into all kinds of cool stuff, and a remarkable person, remarkable person.
Have her let us know if there's anything else of hers that she wants us to promote, because she has been a great friend of the show and a great supporter.
And Gabe, too, son with Hard Money, doing good stuff.
Yes, yeah, we can't thank her enough. Yeah. And also want to thank our friend Eric Metz at CrokerPercussion.com. That's CROAKER, percussion.com. They are dedicated to creating quality handcrafted percussion instruments with superior sound qualities. Check them out on the web, again, CrokerPercussion.com, or give Eric a call at 215-669-8588. As I said the last show, if you have a drummer in your life, please look up their website and because they got great products for them.
Awesome. Yeah, they're a wonderful, wonderful company. And I want to mention also School of Rock, too, in Berwyn. Dave Marsh and Rick Allison are running a great program. They've been doing fantastic things, and the young people are coming in. And it's like amazing. They have stage lessons. It's good stuff. And Wally Smith and myself and a great group. Great group of musicians are helping out, so I want to say hello to them and let you know that check them out. If you got a young person that wants to play music and get involved, go and tell them that you heard it from Andy and I from In the Pocket.
Yeah, that's great. And if you are a young drummer, I can't think of a better teacher than you, Dave.
I have fun with it. Yeah, it's great.
All right, well, let's get into it with our guest, who I believe is on the line with us. John, are you there?
Hey, guys.
Hey, John. How are you, bud? Wow. Last time I saw John, he was kicking my ass on the tennis court.
Oh, yeah?
or we were eating pizza at the, DeLisandro's. Not DeLisandro's. DeLorenzo's.
In Trenton?
But we used to go to the one in Hamilton Township, I believe. Yeah. We used to have a great time, man. We used to order the pizzas and hang out.
That's 1988 or something.
Going back to those days.
That's amazing because Dave can't remember last week, and he's remembering stuff from 1988.
Times, man. I remember that.
I get both my daughters mixed up all the time, and they're like 17 years apart.
Yeah. But we, you know, John and I go back, and you mentioned, like, when we were talking about, you know, the early days of the Hooters, you know, when we first were making, like, our first, not that our first independent record wasn't a real record, but when we went up to the record plant, John might have been one of the first people that I saw up there, and he introduced us to a recording studio, and we got to work in a legendary studio, which is Studio B at the record plant, and oh my God, you know, amazing.
Well, let's get right into that, John, because you were what, like 18, 19 years old when you started working at the record plant?
Yeah, I walked out of Brooklyn College like mid-semester in 79 and just never came back. Yeah. And I was just gone. And all my friends were like, what? And I started like interning or back then, you know, basically because it was every recording was tape-based. I was a tape librarian. I wasn't even an intern. Wow. You know, your job was log in tapes. You know, if Springsteen did like Born to Run there, you had to have a record of every tape, a project number, a real number, and you know, you couldn't lose them.
Yeah.
Or you get in a lot of trouble. So if anybody ever needed a tape to take with them, they had to sign all kinds of forms. You had to really be on top of it. It was a big responsibility.
Wow.
So I did that for like 2 years, and then I became an assistant.
Yeah.
And Dave, I don't know if you remember, but my first legit engineering credit was recording the big drums in the middle of All You Zombies.
You know what? I was just telling Andy about that. I was telling him about that. I didn't know that.
The first legit, because Whitman wasn't there.
Yeah.
And you guys needed, you know, right. You guys decided not to make that middle section really big.
Yeah.
And I had to pull the drums on four tracks.
Wow.
But like there was stuff around those tracks, I had to punch in on like tracks that were already being used because we were out of tracks on the multi track.
Wow, I remember it.
What a way to start! I was sweating bullets.
I somewhat remember that, but I remember, but John, you always were a high energy guy, so like me, so I always related to you. It was like you were fired up, and I remember maybe somebody, you know, but I never thought like this is the first time you were doing it because you always seemed like, you were certainly on top of it, and I remember, and I still remember doing that. I still remember doing that punch like it was yesterday, because I think I don't know. The one thing I don't recall is if I had to reset up the drums, because I think the drums
you did. It was way after the fact.
Was
like really
right.
That's why Whit wasn't there. He was. I think he went on to already have worked on another record. So I was just finishing up the recording. But that was the first thing on the list.
Wow. Wow. And when we set up the drums, but so you had to have all the mics pretty close. Like you had to. But again, we were going for a little bit of a different thing. But
for a really live thing. So I just had to do a bunch of submixes. You know, it was like bass drum on one track, snare drum on another track, and then just the room and everything on two separate tracks.
Wow.
But I remember punching in on, I forget what it was, but even to this day, Whitman says I fucked it up because I did. Like, he won't let me, you know, never will give me any credit. He's like, yeah, you fucked that up. The punch out was
Man. Yeah, man. It was, I'll tell you, and thank God we did that, because that's a real, to this day, when we're on tour and we're playing, it's an exciting part of the show, and I'm glad that that happened. But man, they were, that was an amazing time. And to think about what you've done, like, you know, since that time, I mean, you've always been working on something super cool, you know.
But before we get away and start talking about all that other stuff, we have Taylor just threw on All You Zombies for us, and we can, I don't know if you want to address anything specifically as the song goes on that.
I mean, it was, that room was really special too.
Oh, it's
like
amazing.
Recording in there. Like I it's like, any other room I would go into, it's like, how do I get my sounds, why was it that it cracked so much? I mean, it was just ridiculous.
The floors were oak.
Yeah.
I think the walls were oak, but then two sides of the walls, the back wall and the left wall, had those slots where you could flip around the wall and then make it dead.
Right.
And it was just such a versatile room, but it was all wood, man. It was like reflective and live, that if you wanted to go for, you know, that in the air tonight.
Yeah.
Bah, bah, bah,
yeah.
If you go for something big like that, you could totally get that in that room.
Yeah, it was really special. Now it's a Pizza Hut or something like that, right? Yeah. It's like that's,
or maybe a jazz club. Is it a jazz club or something?
Yeah, and think about it. I mean, you talked about those 2 years where you were logging in. The people, like, I remember just a few weeks when I was recording there, and I'd come back because we'd always try to get in there. I remember all the, like, I remember just sitting there having coffee one day with Edgar Winter and his manager. They were just hanging out in the room. And I remember G and Anton were doing, I don't know if you remember, but I was always under the thought, like, man, if I don't get this right, Anton's coming in. And he'd be in the other room. And Bill and them would really work it. It's like, Anton's coming in. I'm going, oh, shit. You know, it was always like scary stuff. But man, what a place. I mean, you must have saw the most amazing, you know, and you mentioned Bruce Springsteen. I mean, he used to work there. He used to come and do sessions there, right?
Well, were you involved at all with the recording of Born in the USA?
So here's what happened with Born in the USA. So my mentor, who recorded a bunch of the Hoosier stuff and other Cyndi Lauper stuff, Bill Whitman, he got hired to try 4 mixes.
I remember.
We did it in the mix room, and Bruce was there. It was like 4 days.
Wow.
And I assisted. Unfortunately, they did not use them. They used Bob Clearmountain's mixes, which were great.
Yeah.
But I did get to work on the record for 4 days. And actually, what I did get was I had one of those posters from The Bottom Line from years before that. And I brought it in, and he signed it for me. And it was the best. I still have it framed in my house. Wow. It was so, like, I couldn't believe I had the balls to be like, Bruce, can you sign this for me?
But it was Bruce Springsteen. He was already a legend by the time he did that. And I remember, like, going back, my wife, Dallin, is like a fanatical Bruce Springsteen fan. So you can only imagine, I've seen lots of documentaries, lots of stuff about Bruce. So, you know, I didn't realize how much he labored over trying to get, like, he was never happy on those early days of drum sounds. And for him to get, like, sounds that were, like, what he really wanted must have been, like, because it took him years to find that, you know? Yeah.
So, you guys ever see that documentary, The Promise?
Yes.
Oh, so good. And that's all Record Plant Studio A.
Wow.
I think Jimmy Iovine is engineering at that point.
Right.
Which is totally ridiculous.
Right, right.
But it's unbelievable. But it's so, you know, like, there's like, he wrote like 100 songs. I mean, he gave Patti Smith Because the Night.
Right.
He couldn't figure out how to finish it, like, lyrically or vocally.
Right, right.
Think about that. They shared that song.
Unbelievable.
It's crazy.
So you were really, you know, witnessing and being part of real rock and roll history. I mean, that's like unbelievable stuff, John, that you were there, man. Unbelievable.
Let's put it this way. I saw good Stevie Nicks and I saw bad Stevie Nicks.
Yeah, I actually did too. Tell you the truth, because we toured with her and I got to see that too. But you probably saw the early Stevie. I saw it a little later, but then she got it together.
Yeah.
But you work with, but Jimmy Iovine is an interesting person to talk about, because, you know, people, you know, because he became like, went into record exec world. I mean, at one point, I remember seeing him showing up at the record plant when we were there. He'd have his little hat on, come in. He was doing some, carrying some tapes. I'm doing some mix. And another guy I think that showed up one day I saw was Mike Chapman, who was a pretty famous engineer. Yep. He did a lot of stuff.
Well,
fantastic.
Yeah, John, you mentioned, you know, being this guy, young producer, engineer, getting a poster for Bruce to sign. Were you growing up as a kid?
I was literally an assistant engineer. Forget about producer engineer. That's not for like another 10 years.
Right. Okay. But
literally like the assistant, just a kid who's like standing along the back wall, like running tape sheets.
No, but what I was going for was when you were growing up, were you kind of like awestruck by these musicians that then you would end up working with down the road? I mean, were you a huge music guy, you know, before you got into this professionally?
I bought Born to Run, I think, the week it came out at the local Corvettes in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Nice.
I was going to concerts constantly. I mean, I was the kid, you know, I saw Pink Floyd six times. Yeah. I saw, you know, ELP. I saw Yes. I saw the Grateful Dead. I mean, I was.
You were like me.
When you became a part of that world, that must have blown your mind a little bit.
Oh, totally. I mean, one of the first big ones for me was getting a call, you know, Studio C needs an SM57. And I walk in and Tom Petty's sitting there and they're working.
And
I just like shit myself. It was just like,
that's great.
Well, it had to be. Yeah. Because even back then, Petty was probably a little intimidating just because he just oozed cool.
I mean, I bought the first three records. I bought the first two.
Yeah.
I think Damn the Torpedoes was the fourth.
Yeah.
But I definitely bought the first one when it came out. I mean, those records were spinning in my house all the time.
Did you have a moment? Did you have a moment, John, where you went, well, because coming from where you came from, like a listener, and I had this experience too. It's like where you hear something, go, oh, that's how they do it. Like we're like, oh, yeah. I would never would have thought about that. Like you were surprised by how people get that sound, you know? Because I'll tell you, a lot of people like when like I'll go back to Zombies real quick. Remember, like people think that I'm really hitting a gong, and I was hitting a cymbal with a mallet. And the way we put that one together was, you know, like in pieces, you know? And I think the only time, like Eric tells people all the time, he's like, you never really played a drum set. I said, well, I did play a drum set when John and Yella came in. You know, that's when I played a drum set, you know, which was like a little tricky. Like, okay, how do we make this work? But man, you saw some unbelievable, you know, sessions and been a part of them. That's you've probably seen some pretty classic moments too.
My 2 weeks with Iggy Pop were as an assistant engineer were amazing and frightful at the same time.
Wow. Why?
Like give us an Iggy story.
Yeah.
I mean, the classic Iggy story was, you know, he's getting ready to do vocals and, you know, the engineer, rest in peace, John Mathias, sets up the music stand and puts like a little towel over it so it doesn't reflect into the microphone, which is pretty anal, but I get it. And then I'm getting, it's the old days where I'm getting the headphone mix. I'm looking at the console and I'm listening and I get a tap on the shoulder and John points outside and Iggy's lit the towel on fire. ceiling. So I run out and this is like at 2 a.m. I mean, nobody's working like at noon, you know, back then.
Yeah.
In the mid-80s, everybody's working from, well, not everybody, but some people working from, you know, like 8 o'clock at night until 8 a.m.
Right.
But I grab the towel as it's like a flame and do like the dance on it to put it out, burning my hands. And we had to go back to work. I mean, I just looked at him. I was like, I couldn't say anything because I'm the assistant. You know, if I, you know, you never mouth off to a client and it's Iggy Pop. My other favorite one was I had to deliver him a cassette one night.
Right.
So they sent me in a cab down, but he was at the Dew Drop Inn, this really quiet bar in the village. And I walked in, I handed it to him and he bought me a beer.
Oh.
So we just sat there really uncomfortably in this really dark bar.
Oh, cool.
I had to have the beer with him. And that was trippy. When it was almost like one of the final scenes from Apocalypse Now.
I love it, and I got such memories, John. I don't know if you, I used to ride my bike. I used to bring my bicycle up there, and I used to ride my bicycle down to John's Pizzeria and bring back pizzas for the session. And I remember that was like pretty crazy, but I used to ride my bicycle there. But everybody was riding, like doing crazy shit back there. And I just had great memories of that place, you know, and you never know who you would see. And I mean, like Miles Davis recording, like Miles was recording time after time upstairs one day, you know, and we got invited up to listen to that. And I mean, that was your world all the time, man. It was like,
but you know,
unbelievable.
Honestly, Dave, we were so under the gun and the pressure was so high about not messing up and getting fired.
Yeah.
That you never really sat there and kicked back and said, this is fantastic. It was like, holy shit, don't fuck up. And it was wild back then. Yeah. Honestly, the 80s were wild.
Yeah.
I walked out of that place at 6 a.m. a lot of nights after being there 18 hours.
Wow.
And, you know, like getting on the B train to go home and just freaking out halfway, making sure like, oh, did I put the alarm on? And,
oh, shit.
You know, if I leave it open, they're going to fire. I mean, I.
Oh, my God.
Two or three times I should have gotten fired.
Oh, my God. Well, you know, I mean, because I guess that was the kind of gig back then. There were like people in line wanting, you know, like, I want that gig. That's the job I want, you know.
Well, here you go. Just to you're talking about the 80s, just to look at the run of some of the albums you worked on in the 80s. We mentioned Nervous Night by the Hooters. She's So Unusual. Obviously, you were very involved in that. But John Cougar. Twisted Sister, Stay Hungry, The Warrior from Scandal, The Outfield. I mean, you're talking some of the biggest albums of the 80s, and you were, I mean, so the memories and the stories you must have are I'm sure they're remarkable. I mean,
they're all different, obviously. Like, some of them are not safe for work.
John Spinks.
But I mean, you know, whatever. And David, you remember.
Yeah.
Like my joke about the Stevie Nicks is, you know, I saw her, she was recording the first solo record at the record plant. And she was just, it was when she walked around, I just wanted, everybody wanted to hug her. She was beautiful.
Yeah,
and,
right.
You know, just really, I don't know, just, it was something that was awe about her. But then I worked on Hands Tied, like the third record, and it was insane. It was just like so train wrecky and crazy and, you know, and just, you know, chain smoking, sick, well, whatever, just not, it was not healthy. And I, thank God I got another gig and they took me off of that because I just was like,
couldn't deal with it.
It was a lot to handle. Yeah. You know, inviting the Hell's Angels over with their motorcycles one day. So then you got like six motorcycles in Studio B revving. And it's like, you know, you can't manage that. You can't be, you know, there's nothing you could do. It was just insane.
Right. And you guys had Aerosmith in that studio for
I was just
sake.
About to ask, where's Tyler and those guys? Were they sober by the time you were working with them or were they still?
No, I assisted on the record that made them get sober.
Yeah. I mean, those guys actually had to bring in, I think at one point, I remember Rod O'Brien telling me about other guitar players that were playing up because the guys were too fucked up.
Neither original guitar player was in the band at that point.
Right, that was the Rock and Hard Place album?
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow.
And that was another one where, you know, noon start and they show up at 10 o'clock at night. Yeah. And then you work 16 hours.
Yeah.
So it was brutal. My mom, who at 92 still... We'll never forget Jack Douglas and Rod O'Brien because two nights or three nights out of that whole project, they put me in a cab to go back to Brooklyn. And it's like, you know, a 40 minute cab ride or something.
Yeah.
And they paid for the cab. And, right. You know, I was with my parents and my mom still remembers to this day. She likes them both because they did that.
Oh, that's so nice, man. Jack Douglas, man. Holy cow. Jack Douglas. Jack was working on that Lennon record when he, right? Wasn't he doing it?
So it was not Double Fantasy, but it was additional tracks.
Right.
That ended up coming out. I forget what it's come out as because they did Double Fantasy at the Hit Factory.
Oh, okay.
And then they came back and then they recorded additional tracks with John and Yoko or finished additional tracks, whatever they were working on.
Right.
And Steve Marcantonio was assisting on this session.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Nashville guy now.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, how about that? Wow.
I just hung with him. I went down to Nashville to record a record in June, which was interesting.
Yeah, I bet.
And he was around. He was around a little bit because he was working. So we got to reconnect for the first time in a few years. He's such a great guy.
Yeah, I remember. You know, I don't know how you guys did it. You know, we're both like big sports football fans. I don't know how you converted Rick DeFonso into a Giants fan. You know, that guy hated. I don't know how that hit him and Mark. Well, Mark Antonio's there and like
Mark Antonio.
He's in Nashville, right? So he's got the.
Yeah, now he's a Predator fan, which is so ridiculous. I called him on. Totally.
Oh man, it's there.
Like, I thought you were a Giant fan. Well, I like the Predators now. It was like, that's lame. Hey, so I had my fantasy, one of my fantasy football drafts last night.
You did? Yeah. And?
Yeah.
Did you get any good players?
Well, today I got labeled, I had my league labeled me as having the worst pick out of the entire draft.
Oh, and who's that supposed to be?
Well, I picked Mahomes at number three. That's my quarterback.
That's the worst.
They say it's the worst pick of the entire draft.
Wow.
Yeah, which I don't get because he was the best player in football last year.
I don't understand that either.
Yeah, that's pretty weird.
You know what it is? These guys all hate me because they're all jocks and I'm not.
It's funny. Yeah, that was what we had in common. I'm not a jock either, but I was like, I like football. I don't know. I just, something about it, you know, I don't know. It's going to be weird this year with all the stuff that's going on. You know what, John? Everything is, you know, so, you know, so what are you doing of late? What are you working on of late with all this stuff going on?
Well, so I was kind of lucky, you know, knock wood, because obviously a lot of people have not been lucky this year, but I was lucky to have spent January, February, and half of March cranking, working so much.
Yeah.
You know, and in fact, that part of the whole thing was I mixed a record in Spain. I did a weekend session in Los Angeles, but I literally, I think in the 10 first weeks of the year, I was in Raleigh 1 week with my family. Like I was constantly working in New Jersey And so what happened was I drove down on March 12th, and basically within 3 days, everything got shut down.
Yeah. Yeah.
And and then honestly, it's just been interesting that trying to just make music or mix, you know, safely under the COVID thing. Like, I mixed the next Dinosaur Jr. record in April. I would traditionally mix at his house where he set up a studio, which is really great. And they record there, they mix there, mix there. And it works really great. And, his wife, who's wonderful, just doesn't want anybody in the house.
Yeah, I understand that.
So I found a really cool studio in the woods of North Carolina called Dark Pines. And it's on like 10 acres. The guy owns it. He lives in the house. He just would open it for me.
Wow.
I go in, gloves in the beginning, clean, mask.
Right.
But then once everything was like clean, it was just me.
Yeah.
I mixed for like 10 days. So I mixed that record. Mixed another record, a half of a record there. And then, you know, basically, like I was telling you guys, we were in Nashville tracking a guy who's fantastic. This guy, Parker Millsap. Uh-huh. You're going to love his voice. The songs are really cool. And it's on a really great label called 30 Tigers, who puts out Jason Isbell. And
wow.
Put out the
really cool.
It's a really good, really great label. Like they're wonderful. Like, they're just like my favorite, one of my favorite labels to work for, because they're just really music people and they got their shit together and they're so nice.
Well, it's so cool, John, because you've worked with all these legends, but now you're working, you know, in the last whatever 15, 20 years or even more recently, you're working with a lot of up and coming kind of lesser known acts. You sent us one song, which I listened to this morning. I really liked. It's by a band called Warriors.
Yeah.
They're out of Brooklyn, right?
They're out of Brooklyn and now she moved to LA, but, that was pre-COVID.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. You sent us a song called Relentless Noise from an album that just came out this year, You or Someone You Know. This is just a little taste of that. Just some of your more recent work.
Yeah. The funny thing about that song is I kind of pranked them on that song. When she was doing lead vocals one night, she sang that song, she left, and I was like, wow, really, I hear this really cool harmony in the chorus. So I laid it down myself and didn't tell them.
Wow.
And the whole rest of the record, we just worked, and I said, you know, I can't believe you guys didn't find the Easter egg that I left you. And I saved that song for last. I had a plan because I didn't want her to re-sing it. I wanted it to end up on the record. I didn't really care about credit. I was just having fun.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And the last, midnight, I finished the song. she approves it. And I was like, you never found that thing. And she's like, yeah, I have no idea what you're talking about. And I soloed my background vocal.
So your recording style has changed.
I can't believe it's you.
Yeah. So you obviously you work in the box like a lot of people recording. I mean, are you obviously it's because you've gone from. I was telling another story to Andy about walking into a track one and tape was all I think whatever was on Ventura Boulevard at the time. It was the Alice Cooper thing. Tape was everywhere, and you were cutting tape. So you've gone from. You're going from like the whole analog tape thing to using the digital world, Pro Tools or whatever you decide to use, and made that. And when I hear your recordings, it sounds like, you're still using tape. I mean, it's, you made it work. You're not, obviously, but you know what you're doing because they sound. The sounds are great, really great.
Yeah, let's just listen to this for just a few seconds without, because I really like this song.
Yeah, play the chorus.
That's cool.
It turns out the snare drum's too loud in that mix. I didn't realize that.
Not for me, it's not. Turn it up. No, I love it. It sounds great, man. That's really good.
Yeah, anyway, that's from a band called Warriors, from an album called You or Someone You Know. The song is Relentless Noise. I think I might have said Relentless Nights when I introduced it, but it's Relentless Noise.
That's cool.
That record came out in April. In April or March, but they were on tour. They were 3 dates in with Brian Fallon from Gaslight Anthem opening up for him, and they were going to play Raleigh and stay with us. But the night before in Delaware or wherever, that's when all the concerts started getting canceled.
That sucked
for them. They were really excited. And
that's a good gig opening for Brian Fallon. I mean, that's a lot of exposure. Really, yeah.
Yeah, no, I dig him. So, but they're great. And the band is fantastic. The drummer, Mikey Erg, is just a powerhouse.
Awesome.
And she's wonderful. I love her voice. She's just such a unique person. She's beautiful and she's like literate. You know what I mean? She writes great lyrics.
Awesome.
You know, I'm over the moon with that record.
Oh, that's cool. And where were they from? Did you say they were originally from Brooklyn and moved to LA?
They were from Brooklyn. They were. She and her partner, I guess, moved to LA maybe last year.
Uh-huh.
No, she moved solo, I think. But anyway, yeah. So basically they kind of are a Brooklyn band, except she moved to LA for some, you know, for, I think, personal work. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
Well, talking about some of the more, you know, indie type people that you've worked with, and there's many, many. I mean, Kurt Vile here in Philadelphia is a you know, huge name, such a talent, and you worked on a couple albums with him. And here's Walking on a Pretty Day, which is just a perfect song for any mood, any whatever you're feeling. But talk about how you hooked up with Kurt and some of the stuff you've done with him.
Talk now while you're playing.
Yeah, sure. We can talk while we play. It's a nine minute song. We're not going to play the whole song.
I love it, man.
It's a great song, but
every song on that record is like 9 minutes. And I remember at one point saying to him, "Dude, can you just write a 3 minute song?" And he went out and he played this song for 3.5 minutes and came in and went, "That's great. You know what? Let me put an outro on it." And then he played another 2.5 minutes. And then he came, it needs an intro. At the end of the day, like a 7.5 minute song.
And that's one of the shorter songs.
Yeah,
it's great.
Exactly.
But
Kurt was great. I met him at Bowery Ballroom in New York City. He was opening up for Dinosaur Jr. And I guess he was just looking for someone to work with, to collaborate on the rec on Smoke Rings for my Halo. You know, Jay recommended me, and it worked out perfectly because I was in town. I was coming to the show anyway, so I popped the total Jay Maskus perfect situation. We walk up into the dressing room, and he's talking to Kurt on the couch, and they look at me, and Jay says, "Well, look who's here. We were just talking about you." Uh-huh. And then my wife says, "Were you guys talking about me?" And Jay was like, "No." Such a great Jay moment. He's so dry like that. So Jay, I mean, honestly, that's how I think I got the Sonic Youth gig too. Was Jay was like, you know, "What? You should use Aniello. You know, why not use Aniello?" I mean, and it's great because, you know, I've been working with him since 93.
Right. Yeah.
That's some crazy, it's a crazy business to be involved in.
Right.
Think about relationships with Jay.
Yeah.
Jay Farrar from Sunbolt, Steve Wynn. I mean, I've made 40 records with those guys.
God. I remember, I guess one of the times I spoke to you, I remember you were telling me a story about working with the Screaming Trees. Mm-hmm. I believe that was it. And they had a fight or something in the. They were one of these bands that have some moments.
Mark Lanegan, the singer, wrote a book which came out a few months ago.
Yeah.
And it's pretty much about his life up until around 98 when he gets clean.
Yeah.
And it's a fascinating book. But
yeah, I'll check it out.
The stories are, I mean, the ones that I know are, from personally, I know are pretty hardcore. I know some that are even worse that are in the book. But I mean, I'll give you a perfect example, a story that's in the book. I mean, one of the first days of the first weekend of tracking, you know, maybe the fifth day of tracking on a Friday, he goes out with a bunch of friends. And then the next day, we don't hear from him. And once again, it's 92 and 93. And, you know, obviously there's no cell phones or anything, you know, really. And we get a phone call from him on the Sunday. He's in Philadelphia. And we're like, how the fuck did you end up in Philadelphia? We're like, tracking. You went out for a beer.
He went out for a beer and then in Philadelphia?
Oh. Yeah, and he came back on the Monday. He took the train up on Monday. But we're like, what? He was like, I have no idea what happened. Woke up Saturday in Philadelphia. Okay.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah, but no, they were amazing. He's another guy I've done like four or five
yeah.
records with him.
Yeah.
I've seen him over the last 2 or 3 years. He's wonderful. I always thought he was wonderful, but it's wonderful to see him sober and
yeah.
really just in good shape. And
right.
And like I said, even at his worst moments working with him, he was one of my favorite singers of all time. And but you know, there were things that happened. Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
you know, there were fights at there was a bar in the Lower East Side that was like a rock bar that he got into a fight with the singer from the band Surgery, and we all had to jump in and separate. You know, it was, you know, I woke up one morning playing basketball with my friend Stewart and
right.
a couple of other people, and I realized like my crotch hurt, and when I got home to take a shower, I had a huge black and blue, and I realized he'd be in the nuts the night before.
Oh,
you know, stuff like it was just... it was a ride.
You were living rock and roll with this.
Well, we should listen to a little Screaming Trees.
Wow.
Nearly Lost You, which was a hit on the singles soundtrack and
wow.
hit in its own right. Listen to a little of
cool,
because that's a great early 90s rock song.
You do sound great. They really,
that one,
really
that
good.
One was mixed by Andy Wallace. And
I remember. I think Andy Wallace did that one. He was also involved with that Alice Cooper record. I'll never forget. Like, you got me involved with that, and I was doing. Listen, so I do rehearsals like over at Mates with them, and Andy Wallace shows up, and I forget who it was, but one of the. Because they used different producers on that project, and Baron and Perdol were there, and they said to him, "Do not call Alice Al." And I remember Andy came in. I didn't expect Andy to look like Andy Wallace because he had the loafers right. on and the white socks. And the first thing when Alice came in the building, he calls him Al. And then the two guys look at him like, "Didn't we just tell you not to call him Al?" You know? Wow, he's another one. He did great records, Helmet and. Nirvana, like as a thing.
He did all those. He was the go-to grunge guy.
Oh, wow.
Ironic. Well, yeah. Didn't he do Smells Like Teen Spirit too? I think
yeah.
he did that. For
yeah.
Nirvana.
Mm-hmm.
But ironically, with the Dino record, Where You Been, he mixed that also. Except for some reason, Jay didn't vibe with him.
Yeah.
And Jay went back to the rough mixes.
Right.
And said, you know, I think the rough mixes sound better. And I was like, well, you know, let me just do it really quick.
Right.
So we remixed that record in 5 days at Jeff Daking's studio in Manhattan. And that ended up being that record. But, I mean, I only visited for like 5 minutes when they were mixing Dino stuff. And honestly, Jay was just sitting in the lounge the whole time. And I don't think he was just psyched on that. He wanted to be. Sitting at the console or whatever. I don't know what reason.
But, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
You know what? I'm sorry, but we definitely digressed because we started with this talking about Kurt Vile. Oh.
Then we got into Screaming Trees.
I'm involved here. So usually I'll pull up. Whoa, where are we going here?
But I do want to bring it back to him because, Davey, you know, you remember early on when we were buddies making records together.
Yeah.
You know, I was doing a lot of stuff in Philly in the 80s, right? Tommy Conwell and you got.
Yeah.
And it was so funny in 2010, all of a sudden, I'm like back in Philly making records.
Wow.
And
where did you record in Philly? What studio did you work in? Philly?
Minor Street for a lot of the Kurt stuff.
Uh-huh.
For Waxahachie, we recorded everything at Minor Street also in Fishtown. And then Hop Along, they had their own studio in Kensington.
Wow.
His warehouse.
Yeah.
So we recorded there.
Did you ever live in Philly? Because you're like an honorary Philly guy with all these Philly artists that you worked with.
When my first daughter, who's now 31, was born.
Oh my God, I feel old.
Me and my wife moved down to Lawrenceville because it was halfway between both.
Right, okay. That's where we used to go to get the pizza.
Okay.
And I remember don't know if you recall, but she used to terrorize a couple of those waiters. She'd be running around, the waiters at the pizza, and pizzas were flying all over the place.
This is John's daughter we're talking about? Yeah.
Yeah, it was great. It's great.
Yeah, she's now 31. Think about that.
Oh my gosh.
Shit.
Yeah, I know.
But anyway, so I was down in Philly a bunch, and then it made me remember in the late zeros when I was there a bunch how much I loved that city.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, I would go out like during the Kurt stuff or whatever, like at the end of the night if Kurt went home, I would go out and just meet like a buddy like Jeff Ziegler, who also makes like War on Drugs records. Great guy.
Yeah.
Him for beers or meet someone else and then it was just it felt so comfortable there.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? And it really brought back wonderful memories, and the Minor Street studio is really cool. It's on a second floor, so you have really good views. I mean, now they're building a lot of apartment stuff around there, so maybe the views aren't that great in the last couple of years, but anyway, it was just still such a great hang. And the Kurt stuff was really fun. Like We a lot of it we did in Philly, but he liked to travel, you know, and we did some in L.A. We did some on Woodstock. Like we tracked Bacon on a Pretty Days at the Dreamland, this church up in Woodstock, which was fantastic.
Right. Dreamland. Is the Marauders involved with that place at all?
Do
you know the Marotta brothers, Rick and Jerry?
Jerry runs it.
Oh, that's what I thought.
With an iron fist.
Right. I bet he does. Jerry comes up to me at NAMM. He goes, "No offense, Dave. I like Baby Grand a lot better than the Hooters." I remember he gave it. I said, "I'm not offended at all, Jerry." That's Jerry. Exactly. He's great. He's great.
Working with Kurt, though, he's an interesting guy, Kurt. I mean, he's
amazing.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Wow.
I don't want to plug myself too much, but.
No, that's why we John. This is all about John and Yella today. You can plug yourself. Absolutely.
I do have the hobby, which is the Gear Club podcast I do.
Oh.
Which is pretty good. I do it with my buddy Stuart Lerman, who does a lot.
Oh, and he's great too. Yeah. I worked with him a little bit.
He's next level now, doing like Miss Maisel and all the Wes Anderson.
Yeah, I love those shows. So Gear Club, tell me about this. Well, because you know, I little secret, you know, when COVID happened, I converted my music room into a studio. So I've been recording my own stuff and learning how to do what you guys. I mean, I used to do it like 15 years ago at my place to record drums, but I'm trying to learn as much as I can about EQ. Do you guys talk about stuff like that on your podcast?
We do. I mean, we do. We basically, for example, we have had guests and we've had like, you know, from Jack Douglas to Barb Clear Mountain to Bill Whitman.
Wow.
We've had people in the biz, like promotion people, radio promo, photographers. But we've also had like Adam from the War on Drugs. We had Kurt. We had Patterson from the Drive-By Truckers. So we've had musicians also.
Right.
And it's the crux of it is it's in person, because we just, I mean, me and Stuart are friends from like, you know, 86.
Right.
And it was just an excuse to hang out and
fun.
Just shoot the shit. We haven't really been doing it. We did some Zooms for Eventide.
I watched something, I saw something Stuart was in. I think you were there too. It was for Eventide. I watched something. Yeah. It was really cool.
Yeah. Anyway, so we're doing that. But so my point is, we had Kurt on probably like the beginning of the year. And he does a phenomenal imitation of me, number one. he makes me sound like I, you know, I've had like a lobotomy. It's so good. But he was also just super fun to talk to. And, you know, his process has morphed over the years. And I think he really just enjoys now making music all the time, whether he's writing or, you know what I mean? Like it's not like he's off record cycle and chilling out. He's always either writing or recording or, and I think he's hit a zone where it's really great because he could just go places and, you know, grab a few people. It doesn't even have to be his band, The Violators. Right. You know, it could just be like other friends and, you know, go to the West Coast and, you know, a beach house or a mountain house and just record for five minutes.
How cool is that?
So he was really fun in the beginning to work with because, you know, for example, he always was just great at lead vocal and acoustic guitar at the same time.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? Like I could always, you know, I never had a, you know, obviously he'd want to fix things, but I could get, you know, I could get keeper vocals just on basic tracks. And it was so much fun.
Wow.
So yeah, he's great. I mean, obviously, you know, I'm very happy with those two records that we worked on and I feel like he's doing even better now, but good for him. He's earned it.
Yeah.
He deserves it.
Yeah,
that's great.
Hey, we're kind of bouncing all over the place a little bit, but I want to get back to the Alice Cooper sessions.
Oh, right.
Because no, that's all right. But you brought Dave into that project, right? Right, John?
Oh, dude, that was so amazing.
That was funny. So,
I will say, as an overview, Dave.
Yeah.
You made me look really good.
Well, John.
Right. But let me tell you why.
Yeah. Why is it?
I flew out to L.A., Capitol Studios, to start tracking those three songs with, you know, producer Don Fleming.
Right.
And the first guy to come play drumming didn't use a seat. He stood up and he kind of knocked the drums down a bunch. He couldn't play in time. It was just, we were watching. We couldn't believe this was actually reality. It was awful.
Wow.
And then we had to bag it that day.
Oh boy.
And Davey, I guess you had just moved to LA or I don't know.
I got to tell you, John, I think I was in LA for a week. I went out to, I was really fortunate. I moved out there and then I had to be back in Philly. I ended up getting one other record. I did this record for this band called, the Soul Kitchen. And I was out there for a week and I went back out to work at Studio 4. And then on the flight back, I forget how you got in touch with me, but you did somehow. And you said, on the way home, you said, can you stop by the studio on the way home? And I swung by, and George, my friend George, who has been on our podcast, plays drums for Rick Springfield, was from Paradise Drums, set the drums up, and I played Lost in America. And I remember a guy named Don Pfeiffer was in the room, put his thumb up in the air, and he said, can you come back tomorrow? Yeah. I ended up spending 8 weeks with different producers. And thank you very much, John. It was great. Great.
But you know what? That's the thing. Once again, I say you made me look good because we were screwed. And I named one person, you.
Yeah.
And you showed up and you nailed it. And I just, like the rest of the session, I feel like I felt like a little bit of a hero.
let's hear it for a minute. Taylor, turn it up. This is Lost in America from Alice Cooper's 1994 album, Last Temptation.
Lost in America.
And I think the only reason I got the gig, well, thank you very much, Johnny, but that one little part, I could play that. And the guy before me couldn't play it.
When he tried to play that, he knocked his floor toms off the riser. It was, you guys have no idea the looks on our faces.
Yeah.
Watching this guy try to play. We just did not. It was almost like it was like performance art.
Did he go on and do anything else that you know of?
No, I never heard about him again. It was, imagine if Animal from Sesame Street really existed. Yeah. And was a shitty drummer.
Yeah. Right. Well, I remember because I became friends with Kurt Pascara, and I from what I understood, Kurt, if I didn't cut it, they were calling Kurt, which I know would have done it. It would have been fine, you know.
Right.
But I remember thinking it was fun, and I got a chance to.
But I knew, meet guys. Honestly, I knew deep down inside you'd be perfect because of the way you played.
Yeah.
And you know how hard you hit, but also the nuance of your style. I knew you had all the elements, and also I knew you were pro. You could just walk in and just, you know, figure it out really quick, because we were under the gun.
Yeah. You know, when you play with Eric and Rob, they're always throwing stuff at you, like, you know, can you do that? You know what I mean? So it's kind of, you know, it was, but I really appreciate it. That was fun.
But I saw you
do some amazing stuff. I'll never forget the tape editing thing, because that's something now when Pro Tools, that's like an art. We've talked to when Whitman was on the podcast, we talked about people cutting tape and how, you know, how amazing, and you have to really know what you're doing to do that.
You have to take meticulous notes because you have like 30 or that's an exaggeration. You have like 12 pieces of tape hanging on the wall.
Right.
And you have to know where, you know, the first four bars of take 8. You know what I mean? You have
wow.
to know what it is. It's not
wow.
late.
Wow.
I did an EP in Wales in 2015 with a band, and older gentlemen, like, you know, late 40s, who had been musicians for a while from different bands, and they wanted to do it all analog.
Oh.
And we were supposed to do 5 songs, and the band is called Paradise. They released the one thing, and then they went their separate ways.
Right.
But it's a fantastic EP. But the the funny tape story with that was, we recorded the 5 songs on 5 reels, and then they had 3 other songs, and I had no more tape, and we were in Wales.
Yeah.
So I had to start going over outtakes.
Oh.
And I told them, I was like, we could either stop recording and do overdubs, but if you want to do more songs, I don't mind, but I'm going to have to, I physically don't have any more tape. And they were fine.
Yeah.
And like the third day, the singer, a Norwegian gentleman named Sievert, who's a great singer, I've made a bunch of records with him. He said, you know, John, I think I like the third take of that song better. And I was like, that yesterday, and he's like, I like this take version.
Man, well, it's amazing. All the cool work that all the cool bands that you've played with, and you're still like, you know, I mean these bands are the bands that people are, you know, listening to today. It's like totally relevant stuff, John.
But there's so many we haven't even mentioned.
Cool.
Like one of my favorite bands of the last 20 years is the Hold Steady.
I love Hold Steady.
You did two of their probably their two best albums.
Yeah, I'm a big fan.
Boys and Girls in America and Stay Positive. I mean, working on producing those two albums.
Right.
That must have been, I would imagine, a pretty cool experience working with those guys.
They were fantastic. We had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
They were also very pliable to ideas.
Yeah.
I feel like Boys and Girls is the record that, you know, they really needed to make after the first two. And, you know, the proof is, you know, they went from selling 10,000 copies to like 80 at that point. I always say, like, I put them in a tour bus.
Right.
That record put them on a tour bus, and they did very good. And it set up the next record really great, too. The problem with the next record was it was back in the days when that record got leaked.
Right.
About a month before the record came out, it got leaked. And that was back when that really affected sales.
Wow.
Right.
So that record kind of got screwed because of that, which was really sad.
That's one of Springsteen's favorite bands.
Oh, they're an incredible live band.
That's not shocking. Yeah, because they're very E Street.
Yeah.
Right.
In fact, one of the things I tried to do with them was try to get them a little out of that bar band element, just to change it up a little. And we tried a bunch more of that kind of stuff on Stay Positive, Yeah. Whether it was like psych, acoustic stuff like jams or, but you know, the point is evolving. I tried to help them just evolve a little bit more. They always had that element.
Yeah.
I remember saying to Craig on the first record I worked on, I said to him, look, it's not a chorus unless you could sing a harmony over it. Oh. And he was like, what do you mean? And I was like, well, you know, let's have the choruses. Let's have them have melodies and, you know, not walk through them. You know what I mean? And I think that really helped us get to a place where people would love singing along with their shit.
Yeah.
You know? And people would already, but it made it even more compelling to people.
Yeah.
Those are very fun records. I mean, I remember the other thing was like, they were playing me demos, and I said to the guitar player, and he got really mad. I was like, you got any bridges on this record? He was like, what do you mean? Like, is there a bridging? He was like, you're an asshole. I was like, yeah, but are there any bridges on this record? You know what I mean? It was like stuff like that. It was fun to do with them because you wouldn't really get mad,
right?
But you know, they would realize it. That, you know, it was like nice to have a third section or something.
Right. Wow. So it sounds like you've done a lot. Co-writing with these guys, like some of the stuff you're producing, but you have to listen as a writer. You had to become evolved as a producer writer. I mean, like, that's something that's happened with you. You know that, right?
Right? Well, here's what really happened. Okay. Is, you know, when I first, so I did the Screaming Trees and Dino around the same time in the early 90s when grunge was really happening.
Yeah.
And then A&R people started looking at the credits and realizing that not my name, even as an engineer, was involved.
Right.
And I think people started realizing that I was doing more than just engineering.
Mm.
And then I started getting hired to produce records, but I was still an engineer. So I had to figure out what a producer actually does. No, but seriously, right. I had to really work.
Yeah.
I've continued to do that through the 90s, through the zeros. And now one of my biggest pleasures, whether it's working with Warriors or Parker Millsap, what I just told you about, was my biggest pleasure is the pre-production. And I'm listening to songs and writing comments and suggesting new sections and harmonies,
arrangements,
keys. And I really, really enjoy that. I mean, it's a thing where, honestly, I think why I enjoy, you know, it's going to be 40 years soon of me being an engineer producer something. And I think what really makes me enjoy it still is the challenge of trying to be essential in the making record making process. You know, the just being an engineer now, it's great. I love it. You know, engineers are great, you know, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. It's a wonderful thing to do, but like now anybody could buy a Pro Tools.
Yeah. Look, I did. I did. Right.
You know? But the point is, so I'm constantly trying to figure out what makes me essential.
Exactly.
Why a Parker Millsap or a Warriors or Laura Stevenson will want to hire me to do the record. You know, I've got to really bring something extra.
Yeah.
So
sounds like they're smart.
Well, not to interrupt, John, but you've mentioned a few times throughout the show, Dinosaur Jr. And I know you spent a significant era of your career with them. So let's hear a little Feel the Pain from Dinosaur Jr.
Nice.
And then we can resume the conversation. Let's hear the beginning of the song, Taylor.
Oh,
That's wild.
Yeah, John, I'm really glad you recommended we play that song, because I've always loved that song.
That's wild.
You know, I laugh to this day with that record, but what? That song specifically.
Why? I want to hear why. Why?
Because Jay, so the first one we worked on, Murph played drums.
Right.
On this next one, Jay played drums.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I was like, you didn't cut that to a click.
Oh, God, that, Davey, that's what I was going to say. How about not playing to the click, but having it be like super work? It works. It's
it
perfect.
Works. You know what? It just like my emotions, like hearing it, like, oh, my God. But I love that as a producer that you're like cool with that. That's cool. And I got to tell you, to regress again, do you remember on Lost in America, I was cutting to a click and they said, okay, I want you to pick up at the very end. And I was kind of like, I don't know if I can do that. And you know, but my natural instinct was to pick up like gradually, but you said like pick it up like really fast. I remember I was like, oh my God, but you do that. That's on that record, on this Dinosaur Jr. record. That sounds amazing. I love it does, so tension, fun. Man. It's it awesome. Does.
And when he slows down for the second verse,
it's great.
It's so insanely great.
Yes.
But it's like, what?
Yeah. It's wonderful, man. It's really, really great.
Yeah, if you don't know, folks, the song is Feel the Pain. It's from 1994's Without a Sound, Dinosaur Jr. And our guest, John Aniello, was the engineer, mixer on that. And spent a lot of other work with those guys.
It also has one of the funniest videos.
I'm going to have to look it up.
Yes, it does.
It's a video. They're playing golf across Manhattan. And it's just so silly, but great.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, talk about.
Hey, I just wanted to say one thing really quick. This just came up on my email. So the last thing I did before COVID hit in March was I mixed a band for New West called The Nude Party, and it's like 6 25-year-old kids who are fantastic.
Yeah.
But they just released a single today for the record called Lonely Heather, and it's a video too. So look at that, because they're really a fun band. They're definitely influenced by a lot of amazing music from like when we were growing up.
Wow.
And just great kids. They have a few things out. They have a previous record out that's really great. But I just saw it came up. And I feel like those guys were touring so much before they got shut down.
Yeah.
But they were selling out, you know, small, you know, clubs. Yeah. But they were really great. And my wife went to one of the shows in Raleigh. And she said it was like a bunch of 16-year-olds and a bunch of 45-year-olds. You know what I mean?
Love it.
Everybody cool. The kids love them and the adults love them.
What's the name of the band again, John?
The Nude Party.
Okay. But they do actually wear clothes on stage?
Yes, they do. They okay. I don't the name is fantastic though. They're just great kids. They're just, you know, if you Google them, they have a couple of things. They've released a previous video from this record, which is another great video. They really got a good thing going on because they're image wise, they really are good at the videos. And like I said, up until the COVID, they really had made a presence touring a bunch. So anyway, the only reason I recommend it is because it premiered today. Seems like it would be a fun thing for people to check out.
Where's the Nude Party from? What town?
So I got hip to them because they all met at a college down here near Raleigh.
Right.
But they all live in the Woodstock Catskills area now.
Oh, no.
They all live together in a house. So, but I think that's how they met. They became a band down in the Raleigh area. And in fact, my local record store, School Kids, one of the things when I moved down here, I found the cool record store and just started hanging out there and buying records and talking. And one of the guys who works there hit me to them and said, you really got to check out this band, The Nude Party. And I followed up and, you know, they're fantastic. And I ended up working with them, which was great.
I love that you're helping to break new bands. I mean, because, you know, people say, oh, there's no good music anymore. Bullshit. I mean, you can't find it on the radio, most likely, but it's out there. So and I love that you're working with some of these young bands. And
well, I find it fun in a sense that, you know, like, they're the only kids that age who listen to me. My kids don't fucking listen to me, right? So, but these guys, when I say something, they actually listen. Or whether it's them or Hop Along or whoever, right. Like, they listen to me. And it's really fun because I'm not a my way or the highway guy.
Yeah.
But the point is, like, I say stuff and we, you know, a lot of, I always say if I make you know, 12, if I have 12 ideas about a song and six of them work, that's fine for me. You know, as long as the song gets better,
yeah.
You know, that's all I care about. And a lot of times my ideas maybe don't work, but it gets the artist thinking. I'll give you a perfect example. Parker had a song that is on the record that we love, but I didn't like the original version of it. It was too kind of like, I don't know, mellow or small or something. I just didn't like the direction.
Right.
So I recommended he approach it like as if it's like the Ed Sheeran U2 single that he had, that kind of he rips off U2 on it. But I mean, I forget the name of the song. I think he does it in a really interesting way. And I recommended Parker try something like that in that vein. But he couldn't make it happen, so he kind of clicked into this Lou Reed thing, which actually is like 10 times better than my idea. But the point is, I didn't suggest my thing, he wouldn't have gotten to Lou Reed.
Right.
And now it's like the epic song on the record.
Wow.
You know?
I guess
stuff like that that makes me feel that I feel good about that. I feel like, you know, we accomplished something that, you know, well, I would have just not put the song on the record as in the original one, but he made it into like the centerpiece of the record, kind of.
I guess those moments like that just that come out of, you know, unexpected moments where things lead in ways maybe you weren't planning. They have to, you know, I guess that keeps your job fresh and exciting after 40 years.
Yeah. And your enthusiasm is just, I can hear it in your voice, John. It's just so awesome to hear, man, that you're just having such a blast doing what you're doing. It's great.
Well, you know, the other option is to spend more time with my family, which would blow. So.
Well, on that note, now that you've pissed off your entire family, do actually have to wrap things up,
John,
here, unfortunately.
Okay, but you made my day, man. I was so happy to get you on, man. I miss
so
you
much for asking me to do this.
Are you kidding me? I've been one since we started. You was like, I got to get John on because I thought it would be great.
No,
and you're
great.
Doing such great work, and you've just gotten better and better and better. And that's no bullshit, man. It's just really exciting for me to see, man. I love it, man.
This was very much fun, and I know you said it was going to be fun, so
yeah, it's good
you delivered again. But but thank you guys, and I'll keep an eye out. And Davey, you
love
know
you,
whenever you get bored, man, drop me a line.
We'll do, John.
All right. Thanks, the great John and Yellow.
Oh, buddy, see you. Ain't he great?
You were right, Dave. He was fantastic. What a life. We say that a lot with our guests, but I mean, it's true. What a life some of these guys have led.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just the people they work with and the stories and
And he's such a good guy. I mean,
literally putting out Iggy Pop's fires. I mean, that's
And he's a great, great. I mean, I remember when we were working together, you know, going out for pizza, and even when he was living in Lawrenceville, meeting up for pizza with his family. He's just such a good dude.
Yeah, he really sounds, and the enthusiasm. You're right; it shines for someone who's been doing it as long as he has to still be as gung ho and enthusiastic.
Right.
Is great.
Yeah.
Well, another great week here, episode 72, our 2-year anniversary on Sunday. Any fan of the show, go out on Sunday and celebrate us somehow. It's our it's our 2-year anniversary. Have a drink for us on Sunday. Thanks to Taylor Behind the Glass. Thanks to Wildfire Radio. Thanks to Philly Rock Radio. Thanks to CrokerPercussion.com, GotPeace.com. For Dave, I'm Andy. We'll see you next time.
Nakamine.
On In the Pocket.